Our next case this morning is number 064303, the United States against Shavers. Mr. Wasserman.
Good morning. On behalf of my client, I thank you for this opportunity. Our position is that the district court abused its discretion in denying, without a hearing, Mr. Shavers' motion to withdraw his plea. Why? Because the district court never established a sufficient independent factual basis so that the trier of fact, in this case, the court taking the plea, could find him guilty of the charge. It's an unusual charge. This is a case, I believe, of first impression. I haven't found any other case anywhere specifically dealing with 49 U.S.C. 46505 sub B sub 2 in this context. What is the basis for the claim that the factual basis was not established? Sub 2 contains both a completed crime and the inchoate crime in two forms. Has placed. That's not the issue in this case. Attempted to place. That's not the issue either because Mr. Shavers didn't do that by himself. So we've always assumed, Your Honors, that we were operating under the or attempted to have placed a loaded firearm on that aircraft in property not accessible to passengers in flight. That's always been the assumption that was made by the parties and by the court. Now, you have the language attempted. That means now that we're in the realm of a specific intent crime, because this is an attempt. That means that you have to knowingly do something which leads toward the accomplishment or fulfillment of the act, which is get that loaded firearm into that airplane where it's not accessible to passengers in flight. That's why, although
we're not dealing with an attempt, but with the completed crime, under this subsection, would it have been necessary for the government to prove that your client knew that the weapon was loaded?
I think that is well within the purview of this statute if that weapon makes it onto that airplane, for the Congress to regulate that on a strict liability basis.
Does this statute do that?
Well, in the first clause, has placed, if we were operating under that, in other words, had he successfully completed the crime, I wouldn't be making this argument. That's true. But this crime is an attempted crime. It's unusual for a statute to do both, to prescribe both, but it does. But what's missing, in my view, from the acceptance of the plea is that Mr. Shavers, and no one ever asked him, they didn't ask him at the, well, what they asked him at the airport was, is it loaded? And he said no. You know, the only cases I've ever found on this point are where people are asked that question, but it's in their carry-on luggage, and then the excuse that they always have is that, oh, I didn't even know the gun was there in the couple of cases that I found. But nonetheless, in this case, he's asked, is it loaded? He says no. It goes to the TSA screeners, they put it on the belt, and of course it alarms. But no one after that, not the agents at the ticket counter, not the TSA agents, not the TSA investigating agents, not the U.S. attorney who had the opportunity to during the plea colloquy, according to the notes taken by Judge Stadmiller, and in fact not the court itself, ever asked him, now, Mr. Shavers, when you gave that gun to TSA agents to have him screened, come on, Mr. Shavers, you knew it was loaded, didn't you? No one ever asked him that. So what did Mr. Shavers plead to knowing that he was doing? Nothing more, in my view, than handing that weapon case over to TSA agents. Now, obviously, he knew he did that. You know, when he first got to the airport, he went up to the ticket agents and said, I've got a gun to declare. So there's no question that he knew he was handing them the gun. But in my view, and again, this is a case of first impression, so... But it does seem to me that the government would have been required to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, or the court accept that Mr. Shavers was waiving his right to make them prove beyond a reasonable doubt, that he knew that there were cartridges in that weapon when he handed it to TSA screeners. As a matter of fact, you could make the claim, because this is an attempt requiring specific intent, that the government would have to prove that he was trying to, if you will, get one past TSA screeners. Not just that he knew that it was there, but it was his actual intent was to get a loaded weapon in the passenger inaccessible section of that aircraft. But none of that happened in this case. Mr. Chambers, as you know, on his own, shortly after the acceptance of the plea, requested that he withdraw his plea. Then I was appointed. I filed the formal motion, and it went through a number of permutations, but it was denied without a hearing. But that's my argument, that a sufficient factual basis was never established to show that he knew that there were cartridges in that weapon when he handed it to TSA screeners. And I believe that must be shown in this case before a plea can be accepted. Usually in circumstances like this, this is precisely the kind of factual question that you want a jury to decide. Did he really know that that weapon was in his luggage? Did he really know that it was loaded? These are usually jury questions. Well, when you do a plea, of course, you ask the defendant, well, did he do the crime? And he said yes. Well, but again, if you look at the plea agreement, you see that knowingly in the plea agreement covers the entire subsection 2. And so what should have been done, in my view, was someone, the government, but really the court has the obligation to do this, is to hone in on what it was that he knew. Failing that, I believe Mr. Chambers should be allowed to withdraw his plea. In the alternative, and I put that in my brief, because we have three different district court judges involved, Judge Stommiller took the plea, Judge Rando was involved for a short time, recused himself. Ultimately, Judge Covert came in and denied it without a hearing. In the alternative, perhaps a hearing would be appropriate.
Would it indicate why three judges were involved in this thing?
We do not know. You can ask Ms. Kraft, but we talked about this. We don't know why Judge Stottmiller recused himself. We simply don't know. It's a one-line order. Judge Brandon did because he discovered that he was related to a transactional witness. And then it went to Judge Clifford, who operated basically as this court does on paper, but without even the benefit of argument. And that's what brought us here. If not, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman. And we'll hear now from Ms. Kraft.
Morning, Your Honors. Carol Kraft from the Eastern District of Wisconsin for the United States. It is the position of the government that Judge Clifford did not abuse his discretion when he denied Mr. Chambers' motion to withdraw his guilty plea. When a thorough guilty plea hearing with a defendant under oath has been held, a defendant bears the burden of showing that there's a fair and just reason for him to withdraw his guilty plea.
Say it was a thorough plea colloquy, but the judge never did ask whether he knew that that weapon was loaded.
That's correct, Judge.
He was pleading guilty to an attempt, is that correct?
He was pleading guilty to a knowing attempt to place a loaded firearm in the passenger compartment of an airline. That's correct.
Mr. Wasserman, correct that under those circumstances, he had to know that the gun was loaded. He had to intend to place a loaded weapon in the luggage.
I believe that's correct, yes.
Why wasn't he ever asked specifically, did you know the gun was loaded?
Judge, I can't answer that question. I wasn't the prosecutor below, and I certainly wasn't the judge. But I can tell the court that if the court looks at the record, there is ample evidence to show that he, in fact, understood that that's the charge that he was pleading guilty to. First, the plea agreement contains the three elements that the government must show beyond a reasonable doubt. Judge Stadmiller asked him whether or not he had read the plea agreement. Judge Stadmiller asked him whether or not he had enough time to understand the plea agreement. He told Judge Stadmiller that he had discussed it at length with his attorney. His attorney, who was in court with him at that point in time, said, we spent approximately 10 hours discussing all aspects of this case.
And 10 hours or two now?
Well, 10 hours discussing all aspects of this case and at least two on the plea agreement face-to-face. He said that there was additional telephone time that was not included in that.
The whole point of the plea colloquy under Rule 11, that the person stands before the judge and out of his own mouth convinces the judicial officer that, in fact, he committed those elements.
Well, and I believe Judge Stadmiller was convinced, because he then went on at the time that he took the plea to say to Mr. Chavers, now, Mr. Chavers, I'm going to ask you, what is your plea to this charge? Did you knowingly, he read the indictment to him, did you knowingly attempt to have placed a loaded firearm on an aircraft intended for operation in air transportation in property not accessible to passengers in flight? And the defendant said, yes, I am guilty of this offense. And I believe that both the reading of the charge, the statutory language by Judge Stadmiller, in connection with the indications in the record that he had thoroughly discussed the plea agreement, which in fact informed him that the government must show that his actions were knowing, are sufficient for...
Help me out here. That subdivision doesn't use the term knowingly, does it?
But the indictment does. The indictment says...
The indictment does, but not the statute he was charged with, right?
Perhaps not. I am not sure. But I know that the indictment does, and I also know that Judge Stadmiller used that language when he asked for the defendant's plea in this case. And... he said, all right, Mr. Chavers, I'm now going to formally ask you how you plead to the offense charged in count one of the indictment in which you are charged by the grand jury with, on or about May 18, 2004, here in the state and Eastern District of Wisconsin, with knowingly attempting to have placed a loaded firearm on an aircraft intended for operation in air transportation and property not accessible to passengers in flight, the offense constituting a violation of Title 49 of the U.S. Code Section 46505B sub 2. How do you plead to that offense? Guilty, Your Honor. At no time during this plea colloquy did the defendant ever equivocate. Did he ever say, gosh, I didn't know that I had to know that the firearm was loaded at the time that I placed it. At no time did he ever express any doubt as to whether or not he was guilty of this offense. And if the court looks at the record, there was really never any time where he maintained, as he did, as he said he did in his motion to withdraw, that he was innocent of this offense. And in fact, if the court, although the factual basis in the plea agreement, I would concede, might have been made better by adding that particular language. In the PSR, which I believe is part of this record, there is sort of an expanded factual basis. And at that point in the PSR, there is an indication that a deputy heard at the time that he was apprehended the defendant say he wasn't concerned if they took his ammunition, he'd be able to get more, and that he had carried the gun in this manner at least seven times on previous flights. He didn't say, oh my gosh, I had no idea that the gun was loaded. And he didn't say at any time during the plea colloquy that he had any questions about whether or not he was guilty of the offense that he had been charged with. It's the government's position that he, in fact, that the plea colloquy, in fact, established that the defendant knew what he was pleading guilty to.
He'd have to be a pretty good grammarian to have picked up on the whole issue, wouldn't he, though? Given the way the questions were asked, the whole issue we have really turns on what knowingly means, what it modifies, right? And he had to be able to pick that up in the Rule 11 colloquy and respond to it.
Not just there. He had discussed this case at length with his attorney, according to both him and his attorney. And I think that it's clear that everyone understood that the knowing related to the fact that the firearm was loaded. That's the essence of the whole charge. He had the right to place a firearm on board. He had to have it in a locked case. He had to have it unloaded. He had filled out the declaration saying that it was unloaded. That's the whole essence of the charge, that he knew that he was doing something that was beyond what was permitted. I believe
you. If you were dealing here with the first clause of subsection 2, that is the completed crime, would it have been necessary for a defendant to know the gun was loaded?
Yes.
Or is this an absolute liability offense?
No, I believe that he would have had to know that it was loaded as well.
So the 11th Circuit got it wrong in the Shearer case, then?
I'm not going to argue with the 11th
Circuit. In other words, if a court of appeals for the 11th Circuit can quibble about what knowingly means and they can litigate it and publish an opinion on it, isn't it a little bit tough to say that a lawyer, that a defendant at a Rule 11 colloquy ought to know what knowingly means?
Well, I'm not familiar with the 11th Circuit decision, Your Honor, but it just would appear that if you're permitted to take a firearm on board by filling out the declaration that it's not
loaded
and purchasing a lock for it as required, that it wouldn't be that it wouldn't be a strict liability crime just to bring a firearm that you would have to know that it was loaded in order to trigger this penalty. Now, I'm sorry. I apologize. I don't know the rationale of the 11th Circuit used.
It seems to me that's what the subsection C deals with. Subsection C, which is has a far greater penalty, double the penalty, does talk about somebody willfully taking a loaded firearm. And it seems to me that maybe Congress meant for this to be an absolute liability offense, the one that you charge this man with the attempt of. In that case, it might be very important to stress that, since it's the attempt that you're charging him with, that he had to know the gun was loaded even under B2, as opposed to under C.
In hindsight, it would have been wise, I think, to add some language to that effect. But I do believe that the record in this case.
It's kind of like in civil cases, the one question that's never asked in the deposition, but everybody later realizes should have been asked, isn't it?
Perhaps. But I would still submit that the evidence in this case, that the plea colloquy in this case, that all of the things that contributed to the defendant's plea of guilty, including his lengthy discussion of the plea agreement, of all aspects of the offense, as his attorney said, support the district court's decision that he had not presented a fair and just reason to withdraw his guilty plea and should not be permitted to do it. And I would ask the court to affirm the district court. Does the court have any more questions?
Thank you, Ms. Kraft.
Thank you.
Mr. Wasserman.
Again, I thank you for this opportunity. It does seem, does it not, that the discussion we're having this morning is one that should have been held in the district court, but wasn't. By the way, Your Honors, you're absolutely correct. The statute, 49 U.S.C. 46505, doesn't contain the word knowingly anywhere. But again, I think that that had to become part of the mix because when you have an attempt, again, you have a specific intent crime that requires that the government prove beyond a reasonable doubt knowledge. Knowledge of what? Accomplishment toward the fulfillment of the act. At least, yeah, I think it's beyond peradventure that in our jurisprudence everywhere in this country that that's what it means when you charge an attempt. And again, I think this court has hit the nail on the head, but it's something that should have been discussed in the district court and wasn't. The plea agreement says defendant attempted to have placed on an aircraft a loaded firearm in an area not accessible to passengers in flight. And the second element, as is put in the plea agreement, is that the defendant did so knowingly. And, of course, again, the question, and perhaps it is parsing of words, but it actually means something in this case. Knew what? Obviously knew he gave them the gun. Obviously knew where it was going to go. He knew that the gun was going to go into an area not accessible to passengers in flight. The government really, in my view, is seeking to transform this into a strict liability offense. Maybe that's what Congress wanted. Maybe that's what Congress meant when they enacted the first part of subsection 2 where it says has placed, attempted to place. Obviously attempting to place, meaning on his own, might carry his acts to a higher level of knowledge or consciousness. But what he did here was he told the screeners he had the weapon. He told the people at the ticket counter that he had the weapon. Now, for the first time in this argument, we see some reference to the PSR, which I would ask that it sounds like going back to the barn to get more hay when you discover the first load wasn't enough to cover you. At the very least, I think that a hearing should have been held Absent that, Mr. Chambers should be allowed to withdraw his plea. Every question that's been asked here is one that should be, in my view, answered by a trigger of fact. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wasserman. Mr. Wasserman, you also were appointed by the court to represent your client, and you have the deep thanks of the court for your fine efforts on behalf of your client. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel in the case for their fine presentations today and their help to the court, and we will take the case now under advisement.